All right, we are continuing our study of Revelation, and I'm going to start that by telling you a story about basketball. I was hoping to have a story about basketball from last night, but I don't. The wrong team won. Evil conquered. So I'm going to have to tell you a story that is from 1987, however how old that is. When I was a freshman at Vanderbilt, I was not a college basketball fan. I'm still not, really. I only have room in my heart for one idolatry, and that's football. And so, I wasn't excited about Vanderbilt basketball. I'd never really heard of it. I'd never seen them play a game. But my friends all got me tickets on the second row to see us play North Carolina, the first big home game of the year. North Carolina was number one in the country. Jeff Lebo was their point guard. J.R. Reed was their center. They were way better than us. Okay? Nobody in their right mind would have said anything different. They were way better. They were going to go on that year into the Final Four and lose to the Oklahoma Sooners, actually. So they were much better than we were. And we were all gathered there with the hopes of getting to see a great team play a mediocre team. What we actually got to see was a mediocre team beat a great team. It was amazing. I remember, like it was yesterday, I remember halfway through the first half, watching two of my friends literally jumping up and down, embracing each other, going, "Oh my God, we're going to do it!" And all the way down to the end, we were ahead of them, and then at the very last moment, they got the lead. They made up a 4-point deficit in less than 15 seconds, and they were ahead by one. And we inbounded the ball to this long-haired, scruffy-faced, hairy-legged point guard named Barry Goheen. And Barry Goheen launched a shot from midcourt, and as it came through the bottom of the net, we went into hysteria. And we rushed the court, and I remember we were holding up Barry Goheen, who was literally riding off on a wave of students. I had that big nasty foot in my hand. And the thought kind of fleeted through my mind of, this is appropriate because we've been carrying you the whole game. Just the volume from the fans, the energy that was being generated, the energy, the negative energy that was being generated whenever North Carolina touched the ball, it carried the team. It's really a weird relationship. If you've ever been at a game like that where the crowd made such an enormous difference, on North Carolina's home court, they would have beaten us by 40. On a neutral court, they would have beat us by 39. But on our court, we beat them because the fans were so into it. And it's really weird if you've ever been in a game like that, because you're going, on one hand, I'm not doing anything. I'm not stealing the ball from Jeff Lebo. I'm not doing anything. If I were out there, it would be just a humiliation that I would never wear off. But yet I'm doing something. I'm here. And in celebrating what they're doing, I'm making it happen. I want you to latch on to that idea this morning. In celebrating what someone else is doing, we are extending it. We're increasing it. We're making it happen. We're expanding the victory just by celebrating it. Last week we talked about the reality of Satan, that he really exists. Satan is real, and he has been defeated by Christ. And we ended on one of the most ominous notes in Scripture. The dragon in chapter 12 sought to keep the Messiah from being born, and he couldn't stop it from being born. And then the dragon tried to destroy the church, and he could not destroy the church. And the last verse of chapter 12, and it sounds a very ominous note, the dragon went off to make war against the church's children. And he stood on the edge of the sea. And so what we're going to study today basically is World War II. The dragon versus the saints. And what I want you to see is the dragon brings up two great champions. And they look undefeatable. And against these two great champions, we see the Lamb who's been slain, surrounded with an army of 144,000. And we're expecting to see swords drawn and an enormous clash of the titans. And instead what we see is a bunch of people singing. And by celebrating what Christ has done, by celebrating their champion, his victory is being expanded throughout the entire world. That's our purpose as a church. We don't defeat Satan. We're not actually doing anything. We're not hitting three-point shots. We're not stealing the ball. We're cheering. And through the cheering, through the celebration, we are carrying the victory with us. That's what I want you to see today. By celebrating the Christ, we experience the victory and we extend his victory. But first, we have to look at the bad guys. Let's look at Satan's lieutenants here, the beast from the sea, starting with verse 1 of chapter 13. It's too long for me to read straight through. I'm just going to kind of read as we go along. It says, "And I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads and 10 diadems on its horns and blasphemous names on its head. And it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. And authority was given it over every tribe and people and language and nation." The first of Satan's champions is the beast. It is a picture of absolute authority. He has 10 heads, and they're all filled with crowns. He's got earthly power. It's a picture of force and power together, which is a terrifying picture if you've ever seen it or felt it. I don't know if you've ever, in a smaller setting, if you've ever, you know, been there. In the large settings, we have, you know, empires where Caesar, Nero, who is almost certainly the first person that John is talking about, and we'll talk more about that later, but let me just go ahead and kind of pull back the veil. I think John is writing about Caesar, but he's writing in such a way that these principles apply throughout history. And what Caesar would do is he would arrest Christians and he would kill them. He would, for fun, dip them in pitch and tie them up onto poles and light them on fire so that his parties in his gardens would have plenty of light. He enjoyed watching Christians die slowly. And not only did he have the power, but he had the authority. Who are you going to appeal to against Caesar? If Caesar says it's right, it's right. And so that's the picture of the beast. He not only has power, but he has authority. He can do whatever he wants, and he can enforce it. And there's no one you can talk to about it. The second thing you see about him is he has mesmerizing devotions. Devotion. It says, one of its heads, it seemed to have a mortal wound. But its mortal wound was healed, and the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast. They worshiped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like the beast, and who can fight against it? This mesmerizing devotion, people worshiping it. Isn't that terrifying? When you see a bad person, someone who is using their force, their power, just extremely selfishly, and everybody surrounding them glazed over, like, isn't he wonderful? Isn't it frightening when you see old World War II footage of Mussolini or Hitler and the thousands surrounding them? Heil Hitler. It's frightening. You wonder how in the world could someone so obviously evil draw that kind of mesmerizing power? When you see thousands upon thousands of Chinese surrounding Chairman Mao. When you see people surrounding someone for nothing but their worldliness, mesmerized by them. And the final characteristic we see of this beast is he has a mortal wound and yet he's healed. Now there's a problem with that, right? A mortal wound means it kills you, and yet he's healed. He's kind of imitating what Jesus has done, right? But it's not really imitating what Jesus has done, it's just replacing him. So when the early church was finally rid of Nero, did they think their time was over? Of course. And of course Dionysius' persecutions would be worse. And we see that throughout history. I mean, just look at the 20th century. It's not that hard. Did you think evil was eradicated when Nazism was defeated? And then all of a sudden it would go from Berlin to Moscow. And millions killed there. And we go from Moscow to Beirut. Oh, not Beirut, Beijing. And we see millions killed there. And then in 89, finally communism is overthrown in Eastern Europe. And we all celebrate, and we all keep celebrating right until the Bosnians begin killing their neighbors. Did you think evil was eradicated then? Did you think evil was eradicated last spring when Osama bin Laden was killed? Did you think it was over? Do you know about the Syrian Christians being killed every day today? Do you think killing one person is going to get rid of evil? He just keeps coming back. He just keeps coming back. Intimidating, but he's not alone. The dragon then calls up another animal. But before that, I need to tell you this. What does God say about the beast from the sea? He says, if anyone is to be taken captive to captivity, he goes. If anyone is to be slain with the sword he must be slain. The least popular verse in the Bible. Here is a call for the endurance of the faith of the saints. If you were honest, which you're probably as honest about as seldom as I am, but if you were honest, at this point you want your money back, right? I mean, really, that's the best you got to offer me, God? If I'm destined for the sword, to the sword I'm going to go? Really? That's not why I'm here. I mean, you're telling me that to follow Christ means I have to have a faith that will endure persecution, hardship, nakedness, and sword? Because that's not why I'm here. I'm here so that you can bless my life. I'm here for you to make my way easier. Isn't that what we're being sold? If you want a mega church, that's what you have to say. Just follow these five rules and everything's going to work out for you. And that's great. And that will sell your product, man. That makes Amway extremely popular. But it is not in the Bible. It's not. And I've got to tell you that. The Bible calls for patient endurance. He says in the letters to the churches, all you have to do is endure until death. That's all. All you have to do is be faithful till you die. And if for you, your faith in life after death is weak, you will never be able to do that. And I'm going to go on and tell you, you need to stop wasting your time in Christianity. If you think the church is only here to bless your life until you die, you would be happier at the lake right now. That's a little cold. You'd be happier in bed right now. Because that is not what the Bible teaches. And it's important that you see that. It is important because when you suffer, when terrible things happen to you, Satan is going to come and whisper in your ear and he's going to say, God doesn't love you or this wouldn't happen. Satan is going to come and whisper in your ear and say, if you were a better person, God wouldn't let this happen to you. Satan's going to come whisper in your ear and he's going to say, you know, God can't be trusted. He's just doing this for fun. He doesn't even know what pain feels like. And yet look what he's demanding of you. And when you hear those voices, you need to look at God. And with the most biblical sense of the word, you need to say that is a damned lie. That is a lie from the pit. Because I know God loved Jesus and God watched Jesus suffer. And I know Jesus was God's own son and God had to watch his own son die, so he knows how I feel. And I know Jesus is holier than I'll ever be and Jesus suffered. So it cannot mean that I'm suffering because God doesn't like me. It cannot mean that. And I can trust him. If he voluntarily suffered for me, I'm not telling you, you just have to obey. I'm not being a Muslim, right? I'm not saying, don't you dare ask questions or God was going to get angry at you. I'm saying, if he voluntarily suffered for you, then you can trust him. That's all I can say. You can trust him. And one day, if you truly believe in the resurrection, if you truly believe, you will see Him face to face. If you believe that this life is just a blip on the radar screen compared to the infinite line of eternity that you're going to spend with Him, if you believe that, then you can know that one day He'll explain to you why it happened the way it happened. And He'll wipe every tear from your eye. And you'll think it was worth it. And you'll trust Him then. The question is, do you trust Him now? That is what gives our faith endurance, the belief that Jesus is good. And that's how we fight the beast. But the beast is not alone. The beast brings a prophet. It says, I saw another beast rising out of the earth. It had two horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. It exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence, and it makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast. Are you ready? Here we go. We're going to talk about the Antichrist and the number of the beast. You ready? This is why you came to this series, right? Let's get into it. Come on. Look at the things it says about the false prophet. First of all, he's the appearance of a lamb. That's why people call this the Antichrist. There's no actual mention of the word Antichrist in Revelation. This is as close as you get. That's referenced in 1 John, where John tells us that many antichrists have already come. It's also in Thessalonians, but it's not in Revelation. But the reason why people say this is the Antichrist is because he has the appearance of a lamb. We've seen that before, right? Christ is the lamb. And so this false prophet, he appears to be a savior. He appears to be the one that's going to save you. It can be anything, and it has been everything throughout history. Anything from emperor worship to Nero to Mary Kay worship. Among the Mary Kay salesmen of the world. Sorry, that didn't go over well in this crowd. To Jillian worship for the physically fit of you. I don't know. Tiger Woods worship, whatever. He looks like the Savior, and he calls attention to a new hope. The new day that the leader is bringing. He works for the beast. He has the voice of a dragon. He preaches a message of salvation without a cross. That's what the dragon has always preached. Salvation without a cross. That's what Satan tempted Jesus with. You don't have to die. All you have to do is worship me and I'll give it to you. It's salvation without a cross, without pain, without hurt. It encourages anything but taking up your cross and following Jesus. It's the religion that follows the leader. It's false religions, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, meditation. It's false political theories. It's Nazism behind Hitler. It's the Marxism behind Stalin. You know the beautiful thing about our country? I'm going to say this because you're wondering if I was going to say democracy, weren't you? Not that much of a flag burner. The beautiful thing about our country is we're way too inefficient to ever be evil. To be evil, you have to be efficient, right? You have to be able, like, to make a decision and do something. Don't worry. That's never going to happen in democracy. We're safe. We're safe. That's good. When you read about all the gridlock that's coming this fall, you should praise Jesus for it. I'm actually serious. The false prophet has the appearance of a lamb. He appears like he's going to save you, but he gives the voice of a dragon. And he gives worship to the beast. And he has a mark. He marks you. I'm going to be serious here, but I want to kind of get to some personal things, some temptations for you. What is the mark of the beast? We're told that he who has wisdom calculate the number of the beast, for it's the number of a man, 666. As far as it's possible for this to refer to one figure in history, it almost clearly does to Nero. I think it probably did reference him. If you want to know why, I've got the commentary in my book. I'll let you read it. But there's more than that. We're told that this is man's number. What does that mean? Seven is the number of God. It's the number of completion. It's the number of perfection. Six is the number of man. It's just short. To say something once is just to say it. To say it twice means you're putting emphasis on it, right? That's the way it works in the Bible. When Jesus wants everybody's attention, he says, truly, truly, I say to you. When you say something three times, you've taken it to the infinite, to the superlative. So we're only told a few things three times. We're told that God is holy, holy, holy. He's as holy as you can possibly be. He's superlative. And we're told that the beast is 666. He is the perfect man. What is the false prophet of the the false prophecy of this prophet? It is, this is the way to perfection. This is the way to completion. I can make you the ideal if you'll follow me. And yes, that is a very real thing. And it marks, he says that, and they mark their hand and their forehead, and everybody's kind of worried about UPC symbols and tattoos. Before you go there, though, I want you to recognize that this is not the first time we're told that something's going to mark our heads and our hands. In Deuteronomy 6, we're told this. Moses says, "Let these words that I command you be on your heart. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be frontlets between your eyes." Right here, between your eyes. What's he saying? He's saying, "Let the law of God be on your hand. Whenever your hand moves, see the law of God. Remember it. Let the law of God be what guides your hands. And let the law of God be on your forehead. So that everybody who sees you knows you're following God's law." Even before that, in Exodus, God's about to rescue the Israelites from Egypt. He's about to bring them out of slavery. And he's going to do all the work himself. And he gives them a feast called the